91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. The acclaimed vocal ensemble Seraphic Fire has thrived in South Florida for 14 years. It's one of the preeminent choral orchestral chamber ensembles in the U.S. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We'll learn more about Seraphic Fire from its founder and artistic director, Patrick Dupre Quigley, and its associate conductor and director of education, James K. Bass. They perform a wide repertoire from Gregorian chant to Mahler and from Baroque masterpieces to new works. Of course, there's lots of music in store for us during the hour. That's next. Topical Currents meets Seraphic Fire next after NPR and regional news.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. It's Bonnie Berman.
Our guests are grooving to that.
They're grooving. Patrick's conducting. James is singing.
Yeah.
Anyway, today we're going to learn more about a South Florida, a national and an international treasure. It's Seraphic Fire. After 14 years, the Choral Orchestral Chamber Ensemble remains one of the preeminent and significant in the U.S. The repertoire ranges from Gregorian chants and spirituals to newly commissioned works, from lesser-known American music and all-time favorite Noels to Baroque and classical masterworks.
They perform on national tours as well. This year's include concerts in New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and Naples, Florida. Of course, there's lots more to learn about Seraphic Fire, including its well-received recordings, which have garnered 2 Grammy nominations.
The only choir in North or South America to do so in 2012. With us now is Seraphic Fire's founder and artistic director and conductor, Patrick Dupre Quigley.
Hey.
Pleasure to have you.
Great to be here.
Also in the studio is the ensemble's associate conductor and director of education. He's Dr. James K. Bass. Thank you for coming, James Bass.
It is my pleasure.
And it's so great to have you. Okay, so let's start with you, Patrick. I'm so happy to finally be able to ask you this question, which is, since I've been admiring and following you for all these 14 years, how did Seraphic Fire come to be? I mean, was this a dream that you had forever?
It was. I've been a fan of professional choral singing, I think probably since I was midway through high school. I've idolized groups like Chanticleer and Conspirare, as well as some international groups like William Christie's Les Arts Florissants or John Eliot Gardner's English Baroque Soloists and the Monteverdi Choir. And so when I came to South Florida, I came as a professional musician. I worked in a church setting, but also decided that I would start my own professional chorus in 2002. And so sort of the beginning of a long-term dream with James was actually there at the very beginning. A number of really incredible singers happened to be in Miami at the same time, particularly through the University of Miami master's program, doctoral program, as well as Florida International University. And that was sort of the locus that started Seraphic Fire.
How did you come up with the name?
Well, so Seraphic Fire comes from one of the pieces that we first sang. It was actually the first piece we ever sang as a group. It's by the man that we credit to be the first American composer, William Billings. And he wrote a piece called Invocation, which the first line is, Majestic God, our muse inspire and fill us with seraphic fire. And so we were rehearsing it and we didn't have a name yet. And so we thought this is a pretty great, it's a great image. So so that we took that as our name. So it's the first sentence we ever sang.
You know, you're considered a superb artist, but unusual for an artist to also be considered an entrepreneur, an arts entrepreneur. It's a really great combination, but an unusual combination. So how did that happen? Where did you get your funding to begin with?
I guess those things happened simultaneously. I was lucky that when I was going through high school and college, I was a performer, but also to be a performer, you sort of, and at the beginning, have to support yourself somehow. And so the two things that I did to support myself was I worked at a PR agency and for a print shop. And so that gave me a little bit of the inside of marketing. I even now when I talk about successes, both in artistic and in sort of a popular success, you have to think that the difference between being a star and a starving artist really is marketing. And so, you know, out of necessity, particularly in South Florida, when we came down here and started performing, we gave the Florida premiere of the Monteverdi Vespers. I mean, the piece that had been around for 395 years when we started.
Just
when
made
we gave
it here,
it.
Yeah.
So we started out. I was the music director at a large Roman Catholic church in South Miami at the time, and through donations from the congregation and support from that church, we started Seraphic Fire, and we did that for 3 years, and then decided that Seraphic Fire was I was spending about 5% of my time on Seraphic Fire at that point, and figured that if I could spend 100% of my time, that I could, you know, make a living for myself and for the people who sang in the group. And so I went out on my own and had 9 months of food scarcity, and then
but let me add this.
Ramen noodles.
Ramen, yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Let me add this, so because you
this
asked
is James Bass. Yes.
Yeah, because you asked a question about Patrick's entrepreneurial skills, and he actually has written a book on this now, on kind of starting what we do, but arts organizations in general. And one of the things that always struck me about his idea and what he has said is you just don't want to be redundant in mm-hmm. your area. And so this didn't exist in Miami at that time, that kind of idea of the professional ensemble. And so the vacuum of all that, plus the space in which he was working and this collection of singers, plus the idea was incendiary, and that became something.
And so when you met Patrick and you joined Seraphic Fire, that was almost at the beginning.
It was the second concert.
Yeah.
It was the second concert.
Yes.
And so when you have musicians, how does it work? Are you hired one time for Seraphic Fire and you're there for life, or is it a prescribed time? Or
I think that, you know, so the members of Seraphic Fire today come from virtually as far away as you can get in the continental United States, as well as some members from Europe. Some people sing one concert a year with us. Some people sing every concert. It just depends on both our schedule and needs in terms of repertoire. So some people, there are people who are specialists. They sing either contemporary music very well, or they sing early Baroque classical very well, or perhaps gospel and folk forms mm-hmm. very well. And then we have some people who can just do it all. Yeah. And the combination of that makes it so that I think one of our strengths as an organization is that when you listen to Seraphic Fire, and I've had this comment many times, you don't hear a Seraphic Fire sound, you hear the composer. And that's what we're always striving. We want to sound like the music that we are performing.
But in a practical term, to answer your question, the singer has to audition, and then we get on a roster. And once you're on that roster, it means that you are a potential contractee based on whatever the needs are that Patrick has set forth in a given year. Some singers are invited more often, others, it just depends again on the nature. And you stay on that roster until you no longer either can produce the same sounds that you did, or you've gone on and done something else. And if you're suddenly the star at the Met, you may not have time for us. But you get on that roster, which our roster has about 40 singers, maybe?
I think it's more like 70.
Okay, 70.
Oh, okay.
And so those are folks that we know we've worked with before, and we go to them first.
Well, I see that you, James, are also Director of Choral Studies at the School of Music at University of South Florida, and the Artistic Director of the Master Chorale of Tampa Bay. So would you say that almost all of the singer, all of you, all 70 of the members of Seraphic Fire have other positions?
Yes. Yes, and one way or another. I mean, some of our singers are definitely 100% freelance singers. And then there are several doctors in our group that have university positions. There are several other professional conductors that have other groups. It is a compilation of basically the entire industry of art music.
Yeah, if you look through the people who sang with us, say, even last season, we have people who don't have an apartment because they fly from one city to the next as a sort of a singer of fortune, choral mercenaries, I call them. Number of choral professors. We have a couple people who have Met contracts, who sing leads at various opera companies around the world.
We lost a singer this year to the Met Chorus, who took a contract to sing in the Met Chorus.
And you know, in two months, you know, one singer is coming to sing with us. Tamara Wilson is, you know, currently, I think, at English National Opera, and she just sang Aida at the Met, and she'll be singing the Brahms Requiem with us. So it's an incredible assemblage of people, all who come to play, as we say, they come to play team ball. We're different than a solo performance in that these are, you know, 13 to 17 people who work in concert to do various things in various ways to create this whole that's greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, we want to talk about that. And just one other question going back to when you first formed that I wanted to know. Did you have any early angels that supported you and that really kind of boosted you up and got you in a position where you could?
Well, I mean, I think that there's no one no one who has done more for this group than Joanne Schulte, who has been sort of a bedrock of the classical music scene of South Florida and Miami for many, many, many years. She's a Miami native. She's the professor of organ studies at Florida International University. She's a fantastic concert organist, but was the person who believed in us from the very beginning, and she was our guardian angel and has been our den mother and continues to be for many years. So,
well, we're speaking about none other than Seraphic Fire with their founder and artistic director, Patrick Dupre Quigley, and also Grammy-nominated and also Grammy-nominated singer and conductor, James K. Bass. Doctor, we'll be right back.
Oh.
today's topical currents. Hate to interrupt. Talking about Gorgeous Seraphic Fire with their founder and artistic director and conductor, Patrick Dupre Quigley, and Dr. James K. Bass, Grammy-nominated singer, conductor, chorus master, associate conductor, and director of education of Seraphic Fire. Patrick, tell us what we've been listening to. First, when we first came on, we heard every time, first the one we just heard.
So the piece that we just heard, Like Snow, is from a set of five pieces by Morten Lauridsen, who's a living American composer. It's a suite for chorus and piano, incredible setting of different poems, which we released on not our last, but second to last CD, Reincarnations, which was an entire collection of a century of American choral music. Lauridsen is the sort of the dean of American choral composition now, and so we're lucky to be able to perform such incredible mm-hmm. music by one of the preeminent composers of our time. What you began the program with, Every Time I Feel the Spirit, is an arrangement of that work by William Dawson, one of the great composers of spirituals. The soloist on that is Charles Wesley Evans, an incredible baritone. And that comes from our most recent disc, which we released a week and a half ago, called Steal Away, which is an exploration of the African-American concert spiritual, which I would argue is the first truly native concert music style that we have in the United States.
For those unfamiliar, what kind of range could someone who goes to your concerts expect?
Well, it depends on the concert, but I mean, if you were, say, to come to the concerts in December for our Christmas concerts, usually those concerts start with Gregorian chant that was composed around 850 in the Common Era, and often we'll have a piece on that program that was composed within 3 months of being sung. So
you go from the really golden oldies.
Over 1,000 years of music, certainly within the course of the season, but sometimes within the course of a concert.
And vocally, one of the pieces we heard already, I will lift my eyes on the way out. The highest note in that is a B for the sopranos and a low D flat for the basses. So basically, the entire spectrum of vocal range is performed by 13 singers.
You know, one thing I've noticed, and you said this before, and I've really noticed it, is that you feature many soloists during the concert. It's not as though there's ever one star, and it just always seems like it's the music that you want to star and not the individuals, and it so comes across.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, look, we're in a business that sometimes can reward narcissism, and
a nice way of putting it.
And I think that our music making is a conscious reaction to that. That at all times it is music first for us, and not just music for the sake of music, but how do we communicate the essence of this music to the members of the audience? It's a conversation between musicians and audience members at all time.
And Patrick, again, and from the beginning, he has felt this way, that every singer he would hire here could be a soloist. That's the way he said he would pick his roster. And so whenever we do music, the actual soloist names, and he'll tell you this in the concert, we don't print their names individually.
I see.
Because every single person in the group is, probably will be, a soloist. And mm-hmm. so it ends up being just, that is the fabric of how we do it.
Yeah, it's been a long tradition that, we come and we also make the members of our ensemble very accessible to the audience after a program. I mean, everyone stays in the back and talks. And so we say, if you want to find out what someone's name is and you can't match the picture in the bio to the person on the on the stage, go and shake their hands and ask them who they are.
And the other thing that's outstanding, I think, about Seraphic Fire, and I guess you may have noticed this, is not only is the audience able to have the sublime experience, but you all seem like you are totally so transported while you're performing.
And let me speak to that because I sing in the trenches, of this group. And our colleagues in here, none of us live in the same town. You know, we live in LA, Seattle, Chicago, DC, New York, Tampa. So when we come back together from our other lives to this life, it is kind of like old home week. We always kind of joke about that. But it's like playing in a string quartet that you've been in your entire life, and you just know what that cellist is going to do if you're a violinist. And so we get back together, and although we may have a challenging program in front of us, or this piece is harder than another piece, we're singing with other singers that value this type of singing at a very high level. And so you just feel like you're amongst your best friends in the entire mm-hmm. world. And so the performances are not a labor of love. They are an expression of love mm-hmm. as we make music, and also a concert.
I think for most of us, virtually all of us, this is one of the highest levels at which we're going to do this art. And so as such, every member of the ensemble, be it me or Alto 3, is equally as protective of the artistic product, to the point that everyone contributes to not just the perfection, but to that getting past just being you know, accurate and good, to being something that is transcendent.
And artistic. Yes.
It is. I mean, you have an impeccable sound, but it is deeper than that, which is, you know, the brilliance.
I'm glad you've noticed that.
yes.
It was something we certainly strive for.
Well, I'm sure I'm not alone in noticing that. How do you choose the music? Do you program it together? Do a few of you pick? Do you choose everything?
So right now I'm actually working on picking the music for two seasons from now. And a lot of what ends up being picked comes from input from audience, input from members of the ensemble, input from what has not been performed in South Florida.
Okay.
I think I know what's coming.
Input.
Yeah. Yes.
A request.
Gabriel Fauré's Requiem.
Well, you might. There's. I can't. We're not making a season announcement for a little while, but you might hear that at some point soon.
Okay.
Yes. Beautiful ethereal music. Absolutely.
And we've actually performed that piece before, just not on our main concert series.
Oh.
So
it's been a while back too.
Yeah, it's quite some time. But it is a balancing of many factors, which I actually think is the hardest part of my job as artistic director, is actually programming 9 different programs every year mm-hmm. that span a range of, a considerable range, that we don't want to leave anything out, but we can't get everything in there. So that's going to be representative of everything that we do, but also speaks to an audience that is as diverse as South Florida.
And marketable and interesting and all of those things. And one of the things Patrick also has done in the past is, in addition to pieces that he wants to do and that haven't been done, what anniversaries are coming up? The Monte Verde Vespers, it was the 400th anniversary of the piece. We're going to do the piece. And so he's looking for those things that tie in. Yeah, and then we have an opportunity to bring voice to.
Well, we're going to talk about an upcoming concert, and we're going to get into a lot about that upcoming concert, which starts Friday in Fort Lauderdale performance. But we have to take a break first. Okay. So, Seraphic Fire, Patrick Dupre Quigley, Dr. James K. Bass. I keep wanting to say bass. It's very hard.
Wouldn't be the first.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Why are joy?
And we're back on today's Topical Currents with Dr. James K. Bass. And
could we do this once a month?
And two-time Grammy-nominated founder and artistic director of Seraphic Fire and the Firebird Chamber Orchestra, Patrick Dupre Quigley. James, what were you just listening to?
What we were just listening to was the introit, the very first movement of the Requiem of Mozart. What we were listening to on the other side of that break, and someone who just tuned in thought, have I missed the calendar month? So we heard Angels We Have Heard on Eye. We have a wonderful tradition with Seraphic Fire of our local, our regional Christmas concerts, which have really become something special here. And
we used to have them. Ed Bell had...
Right. We came
South
and sang in the...
Yes, you
exactly.
Have.
And we've now produced three CDs. Our very first one was nominated for a Grammy, A Seraphic Fire Christmas. And that arrangement you heard of Angels We Have Heard on High was actually done by Patrick. And we were in process of preparing for the concerts and knowing that we were about to record a new disc. And we had marketed as Angels We Have Heard on High. And we get to the first rehearsal and Patrick says, you know what? I don't think we really have a very good arrangement of this piece and we have to do one. So actually Patrick wrote one that night for our choir and it's fantastic. Harpist Jackie Harrod, I think. And so fresh off the presses, we rehearsed it and then there it is.
There it is. And the other thing, when I asked before the program if either of you compose, and you responded, James.
Yes, that Patrick is a fantastic arranger. And our most recent disc, Steal Away, the last three tracks of that disc are Patrick's arrangement. And actually, even our title disc, Seraphic Fire, has arrangements of Patrick, and he's a fantastic improvisational New Orleans style stride honky tonk blues and jazz pianist.
And this is my roots, right?
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
Okay, so and we'll get more into that, but let's talk about the Mozart. You're performing the Requiem Friday at All Saints Episcopal in Fort Lauderdale, Saturday at Miami Shores Presbyterian in Miami Shores, and Sunday, Valentine's Day, at South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center.
Nothing says Valentine's Day like a death mass.
Now.
But it's a very, I mean, in terms of music, you know, Mozart, particularly in this piece of music, I mean, Mozart writes incredibly sensual music.
Yeah. And this is even more sublime.
I mean, it's just the sublimity of this work sort of transcends the text of the piece into this sort of operatic struggle between good and evil in many ways.
Yeah.
Well, the version most of us know, and the story a lot of people know, is from the movie Amadeus, but the version most of us hear performed was by Franz Süssmayr.
Yeah.
And that's not what we're going to be hearing.
Oh no.
Your performance.
You're going to hear a hybrid actually of several things, which is that there's in the version that we all kind
of... Well, first explain that it was unfinished.
Yes,
James.
Okay. Near the very end of Mozart's life, he was struggling with finances and obviously we found out very soon health, because he died within just a few months of this work being completed. He was struggling with all types of things, and an anonymous commission came in to him, and we believe that he was actually encouraged by his wife to take it. They had family and bills and rent and children.
And so only 35 years old.
And only 35, yes, he 35 years old, exactly.
So when Mozart was my age, he'd been dead 3 years.
Yes, exactly. And my age, he'd been dead 7 years. So he took this commission, which is the entire story is suddenly, it is just vaulted into the mysterious. But it had an upfront portion of the commission, which was what he needed this money. And so he said in his own words, and Amadeus, the movie Amadeus, although amazing, the relationship with Salieri and Mozart, we know, is not
exactly.
It's not historically founded. But Mozart wrote himself, and his wife, Costanza, said that he became obsessed with the fact that this might be his own Requiem. And to be honestly true, at the small ceremony, in which it was December 14th or 16th, there were portion of two movements of this work performed at his little, he wasn't even buried there, it was just a ceremony, and then he was thrown into a grave in St. Mark's or Friedhof. And so there's this mysteriousness about it immediately, and the fact, if you think about, this man was dying. He was literally dying. And so think of the emotions running through his mind as he's reaching the peak of his existence. And this, one of the greatest minds ever in music, here he is at the end of days. And this is what we get. It's really a fascinating thing.
And should we listen to, is there a particular, do you want to listen to the Dies Irae or the Confutatus?
The Confutatus. Yes, that's one of the...
Okay, Paul, that's number 11.
That is so striking in this movement is simultaneously mm-hmm. to this work, he's writing opera. And you hear operatic lines in this. Yeah. And so he's using the human voice, he's using all of the performance forces that he knew to bring to bear in this music. And most people know the story. The commission actually came from an actual aristocrat, Count Valsic, and he was going to have this piece performed for the one-year anniversary of the death of his wife and say that he had written the piece. So now there's a lie involved, there's sickness and death involved, and then in this movement alone, you hear absolute beauty exactly. with absolute angst.
And building off of opera, I mean, having dealt with Mozart's opera somewhat substantially, even in just this kernel of a movement, there is both sort of the all the Sturm und Drang of Don Giovanni,
of later, yes,
as well as sort of the sensuousness of writing for female voices that there is in The Marriage of Figaro. And so you get this push and pull between Mozart's already some of his Italian opera output, which makes its way into the Requiem. Mm-hmm.
And let me just say that this performance that we're listening to, all these parts that we're listening to, movements from the Requiem, are performed by Seraphic Fire.
Yes. This is from our performance about 2 years ago with Seraphic Fire and members of the Firebird Chamber Orchestra.
And so back to one of the points we're talking about, this hybrid version. So as he was dying, he finished complete portions, and then he had portions where he had two-thirds of it done, and he had portions where he had one-third of it done, and then portions he had zero done. And so in an effort to get the other half of this paycheck, Costanza, who was the principal force in getting it finished, she approached what we think his student, Franz Sussemeier.
He was not necessarily the first choice either.
Yes, exactly, because maybe people wouldn't do it. And so there are portions that are both Mozart and a little bit of Sussemeier, and then kind of half and half, and we will be doing those movements already. And then there are movements that are completely attributed to only Sussemeier. We are not doing those movements.
Because, lo and behold,
we have
Gregory Spears.
Gregory yes. Spears. Enter a 30-year-old 38-year-old American.
New Yorker,
yes. When we did this 2 years ago, there is a confluence of events. One is that I spend my life as sort of a Mozart scholar, sort of my period of music that I am the most passionate about. And I remember the first time that I heard this piece, I got past the offertory, and they begin this Sanctus, which sounds like if you know, studying Mozart substantially, when you get to that, it feels like someone takes a bucket of cold water and throws it in your face. Personally, this is the one that we think of as the Mozart Requiem, but it's actually the Sanctus from there on is composed entirely by Sussemeier, and it sounds in many ways like a young Schubert actually wrote these movements rather than a young yes. Schubert before he learned how to compose.
A young student Schubert that only had one lesson.
Yes. I mean, yes. And part of the reason that is because, I mean, Mozart's better students actually said that they wouldn't do it because they knew that they could not pretend to be Mozart. Right. So, I mean, fortunately for Costanza, Süssmayr was, I mean, clearly he had a high opinion of himself that he could do it, but it doesn't come across. And so when we came, I always said that I would just stop at the end of the offertory, but happened to be that the Knight Foundation gave us a grant to create a completion of this work. And if you think of this music and the context that it would have been performed in, any church music of a time period, this Requiem Mass meant for liturgical use, would have been performed alongside of things that would have been substantially older than it. And if it was 3 years past the composition date, would have been performed next to things that would have been substantially newer, mm-hmm. perhaps composed for that very thing. And so we decided that we wanted to have someone who would be reverent to the form, but would not in any way try to pretend to be Mozart. And so this is instead of being someone who is trying to pretend to be Mozart, which no one can do this effectively because no one can have Mozart's gift. They can have different gifts, but certainly not Mozart's. And so we asked Greg, who is a composer who is very reverent to classical form, to write something that is definitely 21st century. So, and it's an incredible piece of music. I mean, it's reverent to Mozart, but it's not trying to be Mozart in any way.
So we're going to get to, we have one last break that we need to take. We're listening to now still a completed movement by Mozart here.
Yes.
Rex Tremendi.
Yes. Yes, Rex Tremendi Majestatis.
The third movement. Yeah.
Okay. And we'll take that break. And when we come back, we'll listen to music by Gregory Spears. Yes. No one wants to stop playing it. Okay, it's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We're speaking about a lot of things, but mostly Seraphic Fire with Patrick Dupre Quigley and Dr. James Bass. And we're talking about their performance of Mozart's Requiem, which begins this Friday night. But what we just listened to is part of the new...
Yes.
Edition by Gregory Spears.
It's an incredible piece of music that is sandwiched between the Mozart parts of the Mozart Requiem, the parts that we actually have notes from Mozart we will perform. But he left three movements where we just have the text. We know the libretto, but we don't know the music. And so when we performed this 2 years ago, we were fortunate that the Knight Foundation helped us to commission this work by Greg, and we'll perform it again here as well as in Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York next week.
Next week.
Yeah. Now, how did you find Gregory Spears, or how did he find you?
I actually went to grad school with Gregory at Yale, and I sang his first piece for voices. It was for tenor and soprano and chamber ensemble, and I I've been a fan of his ever since, and we've been looking for a program to collaborate on, and this was it. This was a great opportunity for both of us.
And I just want to repeat, or you can, if you know the dates and times, the performances of Mozart's Requiem with this new completed work by Gregory Spears are?
At 7:30 p.m. on Friday night at All Saints Episcopal Church in Fort Lauderdale. It'll be at 8 p.m. at Miami Shores Presbyterian in Miami Shores, an incredible, incredible acoustic and concert venue. And then we'll
Saturday
night. And then on the 14th, which is Sunday, we'll have a 4 p.m. matinee at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center in Cutler Bay. And you can find out all about this as well as our Northeast tours at seraphicfire.org.
And each of those concerts, we'll have a pre-concert talk, and we'll talk a little bit more in depth about the individual work, about Gregory's completion.
And he'll be there.
And he'll be there, yeah. And we unfortunately will not have Mr. Mozart with us, but we will be able to, I'll fill in some of the more kind of Halloween-style blanks left about this piece. And this is Sunday. What a wonderful date night if you start at a 4 p.m. concert of great music and then dinner and then a movie. You have a great Valentine's Day.
And I will say, because I have attended a pre-concert talk, and Dr. James Bass gives the pre-concert talk, and they're really informative, and they're great.
Thank you.
They're great. So, yes, and again, it's seraphicfire.org. Okay, so we just have a couple of minutes because you have a rehearsal.
Yes, we do. In Fort Lauderdale.
How grueling are your rehearsals?
We do 2 3-hour rehearsals in a day, separated by somewhere between an hour and a half and 2 hour break. So
6 hours of singing a day.
Yes, it can be a lot.
It can be a lot, and a lot of conducting.
Yes.
Okay, in the last, we just have to ask about this. Pat Maldonado wants to know about your youth outreach program. In the last minute, talk about the Miami Choral Academy.
This is
yes,
James.
We have in the what we've done in the past is we had an ongoing regular meeting of the same students in which Seraphic Fire would have a person here on the ground in Miami teaching a group of students all types of musical skills in an effort to create the voices and the choirs of tomorrow. That's expensive proposition because we have to pay someone to do that. And the Children's Trust changed a little bit of their framework for how grants are given. It changed it for us. And so now we are actually taking a group of our artists. Each time we're here, which involves me as well, we go into two at-risk schools. And now we're working with four different ones, but two at a time.
Which schools are those?
Oh, Morningside Academy, Natural Bridge Elementary School, Reynolds Park, and I'll forget the last one. I'm sorry.
I have it.
Wonderful. But we're going in and we're doing 45-minute vocal lessons and group vocal technique with these students. It's been awesome so far. We've had 6 contacts. And then at Christmas, and again in May, we gave a free concert for 1,000 elementary school students at the Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center. And some of it, which we found out later, about 90% had never attended in their life a professional classical concert. And so their first experience was to get to hear us.
My.
Yeah.
How important were mentors or a great teacher to of you?
We don't have enough time to talk.
Okay. That's
It's absolutely. I mean, it's how my first experience in classical music was a free field trip for public school to hear an orchestra when I was in second grade. That's what started.
Yeah, Patrick?
Yes. And my parents, I was a colicky baby, and my mother used to play Beethoven's Fifth Symphony to get me to stop crying when I was 2 months old.
That's really amazing that you would choose Beethoven's Fifth. Yeah. If you were crying, you would think.
If you know Patrick, it's totally appropriate.
Nothing like Beethoven to get me to
Storm
stop drunk.
We need it, right?
Exactly.
Well, we want to thank you so much. You'll have to come back with the rest of Seraphic Fire sometime.
To. Absolutely.
Seraphic Fire, one of the really preeminent choral orchestral chamber ensembles in the United States, but I would go further than that.
Thank you. Say a little bit wider.
And if your friends don't know about them, tell them.
Yes.
Seraphicfire.org. Patrick Dupre-Quigley, 2-time Grammy-nominated founder and artistic director of Seraphic Fire and the Firebird Chamber Orchestra, as well as their conductor. And Dr. James K. Bass is a Grammy-nominated singer and conductor, chorus master, associate conductor, and director of education of Seraphic Fire. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
What are we going to be listening to?
This is a piece by Dan Forrest, I think.
American composer.
Oh.
How about that?
Wait a minute. Okay, and who is it? There it is.
Oh, this is Dan Forrest's Good Night, Dear Heart.
Okay, and you have to run to your rehearsal.
We do. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Up today's edition, produced by Polly Landis. Additional support from lead producer Richard Ives, Paul Leary, technical director and online producer. Don't forget about our free audio archives available at our website, WLRN.org. Join us for Thursday's edition when we visit with the editor of the New Yorker magazine, Pulitzer Prize winner David Remnick. He's also the host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Thanks for listening. Here and Now is next.